departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
This is your 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for Alabama Crimson Tide fans still thinking they are the best team in the nation. 940 ESPN, 940 ESPN, Fresno.com. Your 2 hour and now 10 minute tour begins right now. 5 minutes, 51 seconds past the hour of 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm the host of the program, Christopher Gabriel. Back in the palatial downtown studios of 940 ESPN here on 1415 Fulton Street. Good to be back home after a hectic but fun hectic weekend in the Bay Area. Technical director, producer, hockey guy, Sharks fan. He's an expert on The Bachelorette and The Bachelor, Russ, keeping us going in the right direction. We'll be cutting out of here at 5:15 today. The pregame show, Logan, Utah, Paul Leffler and Coach Q, Utah State hosting your Fresno State Bulldogs. Big game tonight. We'll talk a little bit about that in the time allotted. You have a lot of stuff coming your way about it. But it is a pretty big game, though. I mean, you look at right now sitting atop the conference, UNLV is 3-0. They're 9-6. Right behind them, Fresno State 2-0, 11-3. Boise State at 2-0 as well, but overall they're 7-8. But the team to really look at, I know that New Mexico buried Nevada, but Nevada really is the team to keep an eye on. And of course, they're coming into Save Mart Center Saturday. They're sitting at 14-1 right now, 1-1 in the conference. This will be one of the tougher weeks of the season for Fresno State. So we'll see how they do tonight. Well, as I said, 5:15, we'll throw it up to the voice of the Bulldogs, Paul Leffler, and of course Coach Q doing his usual great job. Both of them do a terrific job on the broadcast. On the program today, bottom of the hour, Inside the Huddle is coming up in March. That's the really cool event put on to benefit Valley Children's. And Todd Sunterbeck, he is the president and CEO of Valley Children's. He'll be joining me. It's going to be a little bit different this year because they only have 100 tickets to sell. It's because of that. It's going to be a higher price ticket. You're going to be getting a whole bunch of goodies, but you're going to be in the room for quite a bit of time with both Derek and David Carr. Todd joined me last year. I talked to a number of you who went to the event last year here downtown, and you had a great time, and no surprise there. Todd will have all the details, and we'll talk a little bit about why the program, the program is even being offered, and the things that Derek Carr, him and his wife have experienced at Valley Children's. It's a great, great place. It's a tremendous hospital. And, of course, Ronald McDonald House is connected to Valley Children's. So Todd will join us at 3:35. At 4:05, Marty Lenz. And then at 5:05, Top 5 at 5. It's not going to be an abbreviated Top 5 at 5, but it'll be brisk. It'll be faster than it normally is. And then we'll get back to our normal schedule tomorrow. We're normal tomorrow, are we not? We're back to 3 hours tomorrow? Yeah. And one of the interviews that I didn't get a chance to play for you was my conversation, a great conversation with Bonnie Bernstein, longtime broadcaster on CBS for years and then ESPN. She's doing some of her own stuff now, but you see Bonnie all the time. She's also doing something, and I don't want to give away too much just right now because I'll get off track, but Bonnie is doing some fundraising through a really cool program to help benefit victims of the Butte Fire. So we'll talk about that going forward as well. I know that the national championship game was a couple of nights ago, but I was off yesterday, and I did want to talk a little bit about maybe some, not about necessarily too many details of the game. We'll get to that with Marty Lenz at 4:05, but just some of the more broad elements of what surrounded the game. And I know that most of you who are 49ers fans, maybe I shouldn't say most of you, but many of you who are 49ers fans, you have had an issue or two. And Tony and I were talking about it on his program about an hour ago. You've had an issue or two or maybe more with Levi's Stadium. You don't like the fact that the one whole side of the stadium is just, you know, drenched in sun. There's a lot of folks that will say there's no environment in there. There's no charm. There's no atmosphere. I will say this. I'm not going to refute that, because when you have a stadium that is half to two-thirds full, or at least filled with people who are looking at a team, watching a team that it's their team, they love their team, and you love your Niners, but they haven't been very good for a while. They good year here, a good year there, but by and large, they haven't been great for a while. But that kills the environment. You know, go to a baseball game. I don't care how beautiful the park is. Go to a baseball game for a team that is 10, 15, 20, 30 games under 500. There's no environment. There's nothing going on. I can tell you without any hesitation that Levi's Stadium Monday night was as raucous and wild and insane as any environment that I've been in the last 10 to 15 years. And I'm somebody who has, I mean, I've been to Tennessee and to Bryant-Denny Stadium in Tuscaloosa and to Memorial Stadium in Clemson, as well as the Swamp and LSU, Washington, Oregon, Camp Randall at Wisconsin. These are the stadiums that are some of the – I've been to Jordan-Hare in Auburn. These are the stadiums that are generally considered the loudest in the country. You can toss in Texas A&M. They've gotten louder over the years. But, you know, really, those stadiums are all generally louder than what I heard at Levi's Stadium. But I'm going to tell you, the point here is the stadium had the attendance the other night. Most people thought it was going to be, and I was one of them, because we had heard from stadium people that it was going to be about 60,000. The number 50,000 was thrown out, I think, and I had mentioned that, but nobody ever thought it was going to be 50,000. The number that most thought was going to be 60,000. They dropped the tickets, and it was nearly a sellout. It was 74,814, and I can tell you that that's legit. That's legit, because I was sitting in the auxiliary press box on the 200 level, which was in the end zone, even with the end zone that had Alabama painted on it. And directionally, I don't know if it's – I think that would probably be the south end zone. I'm not sure. Forgive me. But that's where I was at. And looking around and then just doing a little bit of a walk around near the end of the second quarter, and then once the second half got started, it was very clear, except for the Bama fans that started to leave midway through the third quarter, it was very clear that that was a legit number. And as I said, you could at times in the game, you could feel the place shaking. Not the way some of the older stadiums shake, but you could feel it. Your ears, you had that loud ringing in your ears because it was so loud in there. And what you saw, and I talked to some of the Bay Area writers, and you saw them tweeting this out on Friday, on Monday night, that it had all the feeling of a great college environment, the kinds that I've been to, the kinds of places that I told you about. And I have a number of the writers' tweets in front of me. Brian Murphy, and you know, from KNBR up in the Bay Area. Levi is loud. David Lombardi: I can safely say Levi has never been close to this loud for a 49ers game. Chris Biderman: first time I've ever felt Levi's shake. On and on. You had tweets like that all and on and on. But you had, I mean, I didn't talk to them, but I talked to several others who are, you know, writers in the area, and they just said they couldn't believe it. Because they were going in with healthy cynicism, and that's what we do. We are very cynical, probably too cynical for our own good. But the thought was, it's going to be a disaster. It's going to be a nightmare. It was nothing like that at all. It was a great environment. I realized that everybody who was working there was putting on, you know, their best face, but everybody they would get people to where they had to go. Everybody was helpful. It was great. I spoke to a number. I went out of my way to speak to a number of fans from Clemson, from Alabama, and they had nothing but great things to say about Santa Clara and San Jose. And listen, I was asked this on ESPN Central Texas by Keont Myers. Do I think that the championship, the college football championship, will ever be held in the Bay Area again? My lean is still no, just because I think there's too much interest in the game staying in places like Atlanta, Miami, New Orleans, Dallas, Phoenix, and so on. But this whole production up there was first class. I mean, it was first class all the way. But again, my focus here is for those of you who are 49ers fans. I get it. I get where you've been at, but I'm telling you, it was a remarkable experience. It was electric. We had a great time up there, but you know, I didn't have necessarily a rooting interest in the game. I think I told you I picked Alabama. I was rooting for Clemson. Vivian, our promotions director, and she was my on-site producer up there. She was all in for Alabama. But beyond that, you know, we were there to see the game, to tweet stuff out, to get video content, and you'll see a ton of pictures on our website. Our new website has been debuted, and we're getting nothing but, well, I shouldn't say nothing. We're getting mostly positive results. There's been a couple of wrinkles here and there, and we're aware of those. We're gonna work them out. But the 940ESPNFresno.com, give it a look. It's much cleaner than it used to be. We've had a couple of podcast wrinkles that we're gonna get figured out. This is just internal stuff that, you know, we'll get it all fixed, because I know some of you have been, three or four of you have emailed me asking, you know, where my shows have been since the second. We this is not anything that we don't know. We're aware of it, not to worry. But some sidebars that maybe you didn't know this was really surprising. Within 1 hour of Clemson winning the national championship, there were national champions billboards that went up in three states, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. That's remarkable. The only thing that I can think of is that they were ready to go, they planned ahead, they thought they were going to win, and I mean, they went up. They were up. I don't know if they were digital billboards or what have you, but the point is they went up. Even more remarkable to me is the fact that they'll do this again when football starts again in late August, early September, but I retweeted this within about two hours of Clemson winning the national championship. You saw one of the people working for Clemson Athletic Marketing raising a national champions banner at Memorial Stadium at Clemson. I mean, I don't know if that was preparation, if they thought it was going to happen. The thought that I had was maybe college football playoff sent a national championship banner to each school so that they were ready to have it to go up if they won or not. Kind of like when you see all those T-shirts that don't get used in a seventh game of a final within the Stanley Cup or the NBA Finals or what have you, or Major League Baseball. Maybe they were prepared that way. Nevertheless, they had all that stuff up. Fans, I really felt like the fan split at the game was somewhere in the range of 55-45, maybe as much as 60-40 Clemson. And initially, easy to think that, well, the orange pops out much more than the crimson. But as you started to really look around the stadium, you could see a lot of orange dotted in where the Bama fans were. You didn't see that on my side of the stadium. On my side of the stadium were all the luxury suites and the media, the media booths are, radio, TV, and the press box, the main press box, as well as the auxiliary press box. Just looking down, and you saw the pictures that I put out, it was orange. It was a sea of orange all the way down the sideline, and then the end zone, just a wall of orange. Really interesting sidebar to this as well. Sidebar number two, you know, not that long ago, they put a mark, you know, they made a very bold mark in the end zone where Dwight Clark made his famous catch against the Cowboys, and it's just worth noting that I don't think this was by accident. The Clemson end zone was that one. That's where that was painted, and Jerry Rice had a great tweet after the game. It was about a paragraph long, but at the end he said Dwight Clark would have been so proud. Obviously, all of you know this, Dwight Clark, it was a very proud Clemson alum, Clemson player, and it was just a neat sidebar to the whole thing. A little bit more on the game, and Todd Sunterpet coming up at the bottom of the hour. Glad you're hanging out with us. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Bottom of the hour, we'll talk to Todd Sunterback, President and CEO of Valley Children's. We'll talk about Inside the Huddle. 5:15 pregame show, Utah State and Fresno State from Logan, Utah. Be a tough matchup for Fresno State. See if they can get a win tonight. Just some of the other parts of the game. You know, some of the things that I had looked at as matchups. Just, you know, Bama offensive line against the Clemson defensive line. And that was, you know, that was pretty much, that wasn't a huge win for Clemson, but that was certainly a Clemson win. I mean, they got penetration most of the night. They rushed Tua Tagovailoa. One of the things that I was disappointed by, you know, I had a chance to go for a couple of minutes talking with Tua, and you've heard the audio. I went, I had my moment with Nick Saban, with Dabo Sweeney, Tua Tagovailoa. I talked with Trevor Lawrence as well, but we didn't put that up because we were just a little bit out of time. But Tua Tagovailoa, it was a very impressive young man. When I had a chance to spend 2 or 3 minutes with him at Media Day, I was a little surprised with him after the game when in the press conference he said he was asked about the things that Clemson's defense was doing, and he said it wasn't anything they were doing. It was just poor decisions that he made and his team made, and it was basically self-inflicted issues that caused Bama to lose. And I couldn't disagree with that more. He was undefeated as a starter until Monday night. And I think, you know, you want to see somebody win with grace. You also want to see somebody lose with grace. And I would say, I mean, I watched the game. I wasn't playing in the game, but I watched the game just like all of you. And from my standpoint, the reason that Bama made bad judgments, the reason he made bad judgments, the reason they did things that were unusual for Bama is because of Clemson. Brent Venables, the defensive coordinator for Clemson, just put together a fantastic game plan. And he added wrinkles that Bama had not seen all year. He is somebody who, he doesn't get overlooked. Everybody understands how valuable he is to Dabo Sweeney and that entire football program. But that's why Tua Tagovailoa had issues. Yes, he did make some bad decisions. Yes, there were decisions that Nick Saban made that were bad. The fake field goal was a terrible decision. And granted, you heard that being analyzed backwards and forwards after the game Monday night. You've heard it on Tuesday. You're hearing it now. Easy to say that as after the fact, hindsight being 20/20. But even then, in that given moment, I know the folks that I was sitting by, we were all just a little bit shocked. You know, that's not something that's necessarily, I mean, every team has it in their arsenal, but that's not Nick Saban's style, because usually they don't need to kick. I mean, excuse me, they don't need to run fake field goals. So that was a win, the Clemson defensive line. You had the Clemson interior offensive line going up against Bama's defensive tackles. That was a clear Clemson win. Trevor Lawrence, he took some hits through the evening, but he had more than enough time. I mean, he had more than enough time to go out there and go 20 for 32, 347 yards, and 3 TDs. Even with the 74-yard touchdown pass, he was still at 19 for 31 for about 270. He had a fantastic night. How good is that kid going to be going forward? My goodness. You had the great Bama cornerbacks going up against the wide receivers of Clemson. That was no match. Who thought that? Ross and Higgins? I mean, you had a couple of other guys, Rodgers and Feaster, but Ross and Higgins, I mean, those guys were just, they were beasts out there. As a friend of mine said to me, in the future, somebody being recruited at wide receiver, maybe the question is going to be, yeah, but can you catch it with one hand? Can you do that? And then, even though they didn't play against one another, Trevor Lawrence versus Tua Tagovailoa, yeah, they didn't directly compete with one another, but that matchup, going into it, I asked Sean McDonough, who called the game on ESPN Radio, and of course he was one of the people that we heard on the show on Monday. I asked Sean, will the moment be too big for Trevor Lawrence? And, you know, and he said, you know, that really is the question. He didn't think so, but that was the question. That really was one of the main pivot points on that game Monday night. Could he handle it? And my thought was that he would handle it to a point, but that Bamba defensively was just going to be too much to handle. And that was flat out wrong. He outplayed Tua Tagovailoa. If you look at their individual performances, Tua, he was 22 for 34, 295, but he didn't get the ball where it needed to go until it was too late. And credit that front seven for Clemson in doing that to him. Trevor Lawrence, he looked like the guy that was about a junior or a senior out there. And when he would take off and run, you wanted him to slide more often, didn't you? I mean, this 6'6", 215-pound kid, he's going to have to put more muscle on him, and he will. But you would see him take off. And what I did like, though, was I liked the fact that this kid's tough. You know, you see a quarterback, and you make a judgment from a distance. Got the long hair. He's a good-looking kid, right? But kid's tough. That kid is tough. And he took some licks, and he gave some. And, I mean, that Clemson football is in good hands. They are in good hands. And then the fans at the game, it's a bunch of nice people, just really, really nice people. I did talk to them after the game. Well, the Bama fans were gone, as you would imagine. The Bama fans were long gone, but I spoke to a number of them on Saturday at Media Day, spoke to both Bama fans and Clemson fans. I spoke to them before the game when I got out of the main concourse. I really wasn't before the game. I got there right just after the game started, because Vivian and I had done the show, and then we had to jump in the car and get over to the stadium. It wasn't a long drive over to the stadium, but as you would imagine, there was considerable traffic still. But just good folks, really good folks. You saw a lot of Bama fans and Clemson fans hanging out together, talking. I don't know if they knew each other ahead of time or what have you, but just some good folks, some good people. And again, you bravo to the Bay Area, in particular to the folks in San Jose, and then at the stadium in Santa Clara. They all did such a magnificent job of rolling out the red carpet. And I don't say that for the media, but I say it for the fans. For fans who came thousands of miles to see that. I mean, Clemson folks are coming. I mean, they're coming from the East, all the way across the country. Bama, not much farther behind. They're only about 200 miles apart from them in Clemson. But it was great. It was a lot of fun. Hope you enjoyed it watching on television. I hope you enjoyed the Monday program. It was a blast being able to bring Rocket Ishmael, Sean Alexander, Bonnie Bernstein, Sean McDonough, and Bill Clark. Bill Clark, of course, the Eddie Robinson Coach of the Year at University of Alabama, Birmingham, the Blazers, UAB. What an amazing year he had. A couple of years ago, they didn't even have a football program. They had shut the program down for a couple of years. Here it is 2 years later. They're going 11-3, winning their conference, going to a bowl game. It's just great stuff. Great stuff all the way around. All right, coming up, we're going to talk with our friend, the president and CEO of Valley Children's, Todd Suntrapek. Glad you're hanging out with us. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
We'll get to Todd in just a moment, tracking him down. Notice that I have assiduously avoided talking about the Chicago Bears game. Everybody's walking around going, I didn't want to say anything about the Bears. But, yeah, I'm just as well. Just it nearly got very ugly at the Bears lost. I don't even want to talk about it. I don't ever want to see another upright until August. Every year, or at least last year, we'll start with last year, Inside the Huddle, just a wonderful, wonderful program. It's put on by Derek and David Carr, two individuals known very well throughout the Central Valley. It's an event that benefits Valley Children's, and instead of me talking about it, how about I bring on the president and CEO of Valley Children's Healthcare. He joined us last year. It's always fun to have a chance to catch up with Todd Suntrapek. Todd, how are you?
I'm doing great, Chris. Happy New Year, and how are you?
Happy New Year to you. I'm doing great. We had a whirlwind 4 days up in the Bay Area covering the national championship. That was a lot of fun. Did you get a chance to watch?
Just a little bit. I had some work get in the way.
Boy, isn't that always a way?
Well,
you have a lot of work because you have quite a big facility to take care of. Inside the Huddle, for those folks who are unfamiliar with it, we talked at great length about it last year. Tell folks what it is and how it came about.
I'll start with maybe how it came about, if that's okay,
sure,
Chris.
Sure, absolutely.
It really came about as the brainchild of Derek and David to kind of pull the curtain back for big fans, big football fans that are well versed in the game, or at least they think they are. And I'd count myself in that group. Mm-hmm. And likewise, fans that maybe are not as well versed, but really doing a deep dive on certain plays that occurred throughout the year. So there is NFL tape there. And David and Derek both kind of dissect at a level that I think most of us are just not familiar what is going on before the ball is ever snapped. And so it's almost like a clinic for appropriate football appreciation. And the proceeds of the event benefit the mission of Valley Children's, which is to improve the health and well-being of kids. So very generous of them, but it's every single person that's attended thus far has commented how much they learned. And I'm talking about some diehard football fans and folks that have been in coaching from time to time. So it's a great education, and the rapport between the guys is just it's a show that they could do stand-up comedy together.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you make a great point. Folks, we're talking about with Todd Sunterbeck. He is the president and CEO of Valley Children's. By the way, I said this to you last year. I'm going to ask you again. Am I saying your last name right?
You're nailing it, Chris.
Oh,
you're
boy.
Dead on. Which just, I'm thankful for.
Well, you know, I am a name cruncher, thanks to having Russ here, because Russ will be like, oh, no, his name is Williams, not Wallace, or just something, you know. So, you make a great point about football and about how they're seeing things, because, you know, we have Cam Worrell, obviously, as our sideline reporter for Fresno State games, and he comes on my program every Monday during the season, during both the college season, throughout the NFL and the Super Bowl, and he sees the game as a former NFL player. He sees things that we don't see, and for as educated and as I believe an astute fan as I am, I have learned about 200% more about football because of him, because he's told us what to look for, watch this, watch that, watch when he shifts over here and so on. And that's largely, or maybe not largely, but in part what Derek and David do at Inside the Huddle.
Chris, you're so right, and the way you described it is very similar to the experience. And it's really revealing, and especially when you consider you've got one quarterback that's got a Super Bowl ring, being David, and another one being Derek that's going to have one, and hopefully sooner rather than later. And they're explaining, based on the formation that you see, why Derek is calling an audible or changing the play. And it's tied to one player on the field that might move 6 feet all of a sudden, and then how that opens up the entire play and why it needs to be changed. And it takes your understanding as a fan, whether it's of Derek or of the Raiders, to or just football in general, to a whole different level. It's really, for me, it's been great, not just because I love these guys, but because I'm a football fan and I know a little bit more than I did before.
Yeah, you're right. And I've had Derek on the show once. We had Derek and David on together. We had David live with us at Game Day Live earlier in the football season, and then David came on with me live when I was at the Las Vegas Bowl. And, I tell folks, and we're going to give you all the details in a moment, I tell folks, when you get a chance to be around a David Carr, a Derek Carr, or a Cam Worrell, not every football, I don't think every football player explains the game as well as these guys. Derek and David do a tremendous job of that, and the event is on March 2nd. I'm curious, what was behind the decision? The event this year was moved from downtown Fresno to a more intimate situation where this year there's only going to be 100 tickets sold at $400 each. Somebody right now driving on 41 or 99 is going to say, what? $400? But when we tell them what's coming with this, not to mention the fact that so many people, families get benefited by a night like this, it's money well spent.
It sure is. I think one of the things you mentioned was, you know, how did we make the decision to move it to a smaller venue? And that was purely Derek's idea to tie the event closer back to Valley Children's, so that people attend understand where their contribution will ultimately land, and how kids will be helped. So, which I think is, just so smart of him, which is, I always feel that way, and so helpful to us to be able to expose people that may not be otherwise to what our work is here and how they can help. And as you mentioned, $400 may sound like a lot, but keep in mind, it is only 100 people, and included in that $400 is one-on-one time with Derek and David, including a picture from a professional photographer and selfies. And then there's a gift bag that comes along with the ticket, filled with memorabilia to have signed by the Carr brothers. And then it's a catered event with some pretty good grub. And all the while, the guys are there. So it's really like you're in this year anyway. For folks that come, it's going to be like you're in a big living room with two great guys that also happen to be professional football players that are terrific to be around.
We're talking with Todd Suntrapek. He is the president and CEO of Valley Children's Healthcare. We are talking more specifically about Inside the Huddle. It's going to be on March 2nd at Valley Children's Hospital. Doors are going to open at 4:30. The event starts at 5. You heard Todd mention some of the goodies. And there's even more. There's more goodies in that magical bag that you're going to get. When you get in, there's going to be hors d'oeuvres. There's going to be an open bar. Of course, Derek and David will be there. And I told a very brief story, and brevity is not my strong suit, but I told the story last year, and I want to share it again this year because Valley Children's is such a wonderful place, and it's it's connected to Valley Children's as Ronald McDonald House. My father opened the first Ronald McDonald House in October of 1974 in Philadelphia. And I mention that because I've had a chance all over the country to see what care for families, for children, is all about. And when you get in that environment, as 100 people will, just by being at Valley Children's, you start to have, and you touched on this, Todd, you start to have a greater appreciation of where that $400 goes and why it's a drop in the bucket for the things that go on at a place like Valley Children's. I wanted you to expand a little bit on, you know, why every little bit helps, whether it's $400 here for somebody going to Inside the Huddle or somebody else just deciding to come in and do something at Valley Children's. The reality of cost for running a facility like yours and the work that the talented doctors and nurses and staff do up there, I mean, we're talking significant costs.
Yeah, Chris, that's so kind of you to say, and I really appreciate it. The costs are significant. Today, it costs more than $2 million a day to run Valley Children's.
Wow. Yeah,
over $2 million a day. And we do have, as you mentioned, a large staff here of about 4,000. Add on another 600 doctors that are here that are just dedicated to kids. I think what many people don't realize is that in our country, 27% of the population are kids, and yet only 10 cents of every dollar spent on healthcare goes to pediatric healthcare. So we feel in the pediatric world of medicine that that's a little bit out of alignment. And so all of us that are dedicated to providing care for kids across the 8 children's hospitals in the state of California will tell you and your listeners and anybody else who will listen to us, frankly, that we constantly need to advocate for kids and their health care and make sure that we continue to invest appropriately, because eventually these kids grow up and you and I, Chris, and everybody else are going to rely upon them to take care of us. And the other part of it is, if we don't keep them healthy as and well as kids, they're going to be much more expensive to take care of when they're adults. So it's all connected.
No, you're absolutely right, and it's a perfect segue into one of the reasons why Derek and his wife Heather are so dialed into Valley Children's, because you go back to when they established DC for Kids. I mean, they have a direct tie to Valley Children's, do they not?
They certainly do. We were very honored to be here for Derek and Heather when their oldest son, Dallas, was born. He was born with a condition called intestinal malrotation, and he had 3 pretty extensive surgeries within the first days and weeks of his life. And that condition is, to say it's life-threatening would be an understatement. If we had not been able to do the surgeries and correct the malformation, Dallas likely wouldn't be with us today. Yeah. So that's how the relationship, beyond all of us at Valley Children's rooting for Derek when he was at Fresno State and enjoying him play, but that's how we really had our arms around him and Heather, and how the relationship really started.
No question about it. And if you're joining us late, where the heck have you been? We're joined by Todd Suntrapek. He is the president and CEO of Valley Children's Healthcare. We're talking about Inside the Huddle. It's going to be on March 2nd, not too far from now. It is an evening that will cost you $400, but don't think of it as $400 just spent to get in somewhere. Think of it as $400 going to the care of children. And what's the $400 going to get you? Well, you're going to have access to David and Derek Carr. You're going to hear them talking about various plays, some of the best plays of the Raiders 2018 season. They're going to answer your questions. There's going to be a drawing. Everybody coming in is going to be giving raffle tickets, and Derek will call up a couple of people. Each of them will receive signed number 4 jerseys, which is pretty darn cool. You're going to get a gift bag. Todd alluded to the gift bag a little bit earlier. There's going to be an 8x10 photo of Derek. You're going to have an opportunity, to have items in your bag that's signed. There's going to be pictures, selfies, everything else, hors d'oeuvres, an open bar. Maybe you'll even meet Todd. It's possible. To purchase tickets, and I'm going to give the number a couple of times, and I'll put it out on Twitter. And, folks, you can always tweet me at CG Program, 877-353-0000. That's 877-353-0000. It's a much more intimate event this year. It's only going to be it's $400 tickets. There's only going to be 100 tickets that are sold. Aside from the cost, Todd, I did not know it was $2 million a day. That is an unbelievable figure, and I'm sure that it goes up exponentially, if not every month, certainly every year. What is the biggest challenge that you face at Valley Children's?
That's a great question, Chris. And I think there are really a number of challenges that come to us based on the demographics in the Valley. So specifically, the greatest challenge in my mind that we have is that whether you're from Kern County, Fresno County, or Stanislaus County, about a third of the kids that live in our Valley today live in poverty. And those kids don't have access routinely in the same way that more affluent kids do to primary care and healthcare in general. And so we frequently, as in every day, have kids come to our organization that are sicker than they should be, because they really just haven't had access to care. And so one of our main driving forces is how to support the communities we serve and keep kids well more of the time. But so much of the challenge of the significant and in many cases generational poverty in the Valley come to us, and that's the fight. That is something that will be ahead of us for the coming decade, and I'm very optimistic based on what I know about the Valley, being a Valley native, that eventually we're going to beat this. But right now, that is probably our greatest challenge, is taking care of those kids that have not had access to care.
And I, a couple more things for you, Todd. Is there a limit in terms of geographically where you will see kids from, families from? I mean, obviously you're serving the Central Valley, but is if someone from a little bit further away wants to come to Valley Children's and has the means to do so, will you serve them as well?
Absolutely, Chris. We have patients coming to us from Norway and Denmark.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. But most of those are not as common as families from Kern County or San Luis Obispo or Merced or Modesto or even Sacramento these days. But certainly we will take care of any patient that comes to us from anywhere.
Folks, we're talking about Inside the Huddle. Let me give you the details one more time. It is Inside the Huddle. It's on March 2nd. Doors are going to open at 4:30. The whole event starts at 5. You're going to have Derek Carr there. You're going to have David Carr there. They're going to break down and analyze some of the best plays of the Raiders 2018 season. I know that the cynics among you who are Raiders fans are going to say, what plays are those? But there are always going to be plays. And you know what? Even if they went 0-16, the point is you have Derek Carr there. You have David Carr there. And that's a cool thing. And as Todd said, they both, and I mean, I can attest to this because they've both been on the program, they both have a way of breaking down film, breaking down the game for regular folks like you and me, that we get it, but you're going to get the depth and nuance that only a current and former football player and Super Bowl champion can have. Did David win? I'm trying to remember back. Did David win, or was he just in the Super Bowl?
That was the year the Giants won the Super Bowl.
That's right. Okay, because I sometimes mix that up, and I get lost in where he was playing and if he was on the winning side or not.
Yep.
Tickets are $400. There's going to be only 101, not 102, 100 tickets sold. The event's going to be at Valley Children's, and it's going to be an intimate evening. It's going to be great. There's going to be terrific food and an open bar. You're going to get all kinds of commemorative goodies, including a photo and your chance to walk out with a number 4 signed jersey. Todd, always fun to have you on. Just a pleasure. Anytime we can give you a hand with getting the word out for an event going on at Valley Children's.
I'm so thankful, Chris. Appreciate it. It's always great to be on, and look forward to more.
Absolutely. You just named the time. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye now.
Todd Sontrabeck, he is the president and CEO of Valley Children's. What a great job. What a wonderful healthcare facility they are. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Coming up top of the hour, we'll talk with Marty Lentz, KOA News Radio in Denver. I put out on Twitter the number for you to call if you'd like to go to Inside the Huddle, Derek and David Carr, 877-353-0000. I didn't get to the event last year. I can tell you that I talked to 3 different people who went to it. They loved it. It was a great time. Derek and David is especially, they're great guys, number one. Number two, in that environment, just, you know, a cozy environment where you're going one-on-one, it's the best. I mean, when you hear Cam come on this program, when you hear him with Tony, that's the kind of insight that you get from, you know, a couple of NFL players, you know, one who played a while and won a Super Bowl, another one who's still playing certainly and hopefully for a lot longer in Oakland. And just you can't beat the insight, but you can't also beat the cause. and the receiver of the money coming in for this, and that's Valley Children's. And that's why I mentioned Ronald McDonald House. If you ever have a chance, you know, Ronald McDonald House, all over the country, all over the world, they will always welcome people to come in. If you want to make a dinner, if you want to organize something where you make a dinner for the families who are staying in the house, if you want to, you know, bring, you know, brownies, or every Ronald McDonald House that I've been to around the country, they're that way. The reason I mention Ronald McDonald House is because anytime you're around families or kids, just like when you're up at Valley Children's, you start to get a better idea of what families are dealing with children. Just entirely too young to be dealing with anything like tests and surgeries and operations, and it breaks your heart. And so for an event like this, boy, it is truly money well spent. Coming up, we're going to shift gears and talk a lot more football, college, and NFL with our good friend Marty Lenz. This is the CGP.
Studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two of your 2 hour and 15 minute tour today, shortened by Fresno State basketball, begins right now, 5 minutes, 5 seconds past the hour of 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Glad to have you aboard. 5:15, we'll send it up to Logan, Utah. Paul Leffler and Coach Q getting you ready for Utah State and Fresno State. Fresno State right now, half a game behind UNLV. UNLV sits atop the Mountain West. Fresno State right there. Fresno State's 11-3. Utah State, very tough team, 11-4. This is going to be a real test for the Bulldogs, and it'll be interesting to see how they do tonight, because coming up on Saturday, Nevada comes in. Of course, they lost by a bundle at New Mexico. You have to wonder, really, if Coach Hugh even mentioned this, you have to wonder if Eric Musselman just got to the point where, okay, we're losing this game, and so let's just get hammered, and it'll be a teaching moment for me. They're going to come in here this week, be a little angry. So we'll see how that goes. But one person who's rarely, not never, but rarely angry, well, he's coming up next.
The Mountain West Conference has never been the same since this former wide receiver graduated from Colorado State. He holds the all-time season and career reception marks for... Wait. Sorry, no. That was a different receiver. Never mind then. Here's Marty Lenz.
Feels like it's been ages since I've talked to him, but it's not really not true. Marty Lenz joining me now live from Denver, KOA News Radio. How are you, Marty?
I am doing well. I'm glad you told me. I saw Nevada lost. I forgot it was New Mexico, which I'm somewhat stunned. And not that I thought Nevada would go unbeaten, but as you heard me say, Nevada head and shoulders better than everybody else in the conference. The rest, it's kind of a mosh pit. But I think to your point, this may be good for Nevada, that if you want to say humble them a bit and say, okay, guys, we got to quit reading our press clippings about how we're an Elite Eight Final Four team and we actually got to go out and play. So that may be a scary thing.
that's a point well taken. I mean, they're playing tonight at home against San Jose State. They're gonna crush San Jose State in Reno, and then they come here. But yeah, that New Mexico game, that was 85-58. I mean, this is a team, as you well know, Marty, that is loaded offensively, and things just didn't go well. And of course, the Pit is one of the great places in this country to see a game. You know it as a longtime yep. Mountain West / WAC guy. Folks here certainly do. I've had a chance to see a couple of games in there. I mean, when New Mexico has a decent team and they get things rolling and that place starts to rock, very difficult for visiting teams.
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, they're one of those programs, New Mexico, that you point to and say they always are a threat. And, you know, it's been a while. And, you know, I know that, you know, they had Steve Alford for a while. But it's like if they can get the right person and have the right person situation there, there's no reason why they shouldn't be a power in the conference and a power nationally each and every year with the fan support. And they do. They get great talent there in Albuquerque.
You know, there's some other things you and I are going to talk about today. But as long as you mentioned Steve Alford, I want to revisit this because I haven't had a chance to talk that much with you about this. I know we touched on it briefly once, but Alford, I remember when he did the news conference in Albuquerque, and they had just, you know, you'll recall, Marty, he had just signed a 10-year extension, and he was talking about how he was in love with Albuquerque, and you certainly believe that. You certainly, you know, he had done things there. He had a couple of rough seasons here and there, but mostly good stuff there. The folks there liked him. New Mexico loved him. They were ready to have him just retire there. And then about, 11 or 12 days later, UCLA came calling. Do you ever think that a guy like a Steve Alford, he'll land somewhere? Maybe he already has. I haven't kept up with him. But do you ever wonder if he looks at that and says, boy, I had a great thing going here. I'm playing in front of 15, 16,000 people a night in the pit. We never got crowds. You know, Pauly holds 12,800. We never got crowds more than 10,000 by and large in there. Why did I leave? You ever think he just kind of looks back and thinks that?
You know, he may, but as great as we talk about and believe New Mexico is regionally, it's UCLA.
I think like
anybody else, he thinks, well, if I want to, and again, this is never a diss to New Mexico or anything like that, but if I really want to burnish and see my legacy and see how good I am, can I win at UCLA with the pressure and the history and everything else? So I don't like how he handled the situation. Two things can be true, as I like to say, but I don't blame him for taking the opportunity to go to UCLA. But how he handled it in New Mexico wasn't the right way, in a sense, to go about it. But, you know, then again, I don't know how those opportunities work and how far they come. So, but, yeah, it's just the timing of it, the fact he signs the long deal. I think that same year, I think the other problem, too, was New Mexico had a great run in the Mountain West, and they got eliminated in the first round of the NCAAs, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
So that kind of left a bad taste, but I don't begrudge him trying to say, I need to see, if I can do it at such a legendary school. And, of course, you would think he'd know that pressure because he played for Bob Knight at Indiana. So
sure.
I think that's the thing. But, yeah, there might be a little bit to say, I could have maybe built something. The fact that New Mexico always has been something in basketball, I could have maybe taken it potentially to another level, which pivots back to what Musselman's doing at Nevada. You just look at that and think, okay. And again, it's a little different for him, for Eric Musselman, because he did stuff in the pros. He's the son of a great coach. And so, and you know, he got calls last year about coaching other places. You know it, but he decided to stay. And maybe he's the guy to say, you know, that's great to be at that, you know, to do that. But I really believe I can make something tremendously special here. And you can point to Gonzaga, and you can point to Butler, and you can point to other programs that we label as mid-majors to say, well, if they can do it, why can't I do it at Nevada? Why can't it be done at New Mexico or at Fresno State and whoever else?
And it's Marty, your point's well taken, because forgive my interruption. It's easier, and that's a weighted word, but it is easier in basketball to say, if they could do it at Butler and Gonzaga or Wichita State, why can't we do it here? It's a little harder in football, but you're right. There's no reason why a Fresno State, a Colorado State, Boise's had some good teams. Fresno State's had some great teams. San Diego State's had some great teams. There's no reason why these programs in the Mountain West can't be powerhouses.
Well, right. And I mean, and you put San Diego State. I mean, look what Steve Fisher did. I mean, he wins a national championship at Michigan, you know, coming in late and doing that and then had success. And then what he did, San Diego State, when I went to school there, outside of having Michael Cage, who was a great player and a great NBA player, San Diego State was always a guaranteed W in the WAC. They were bad. I mean, that was always a guaranteed win. Fisher got there and was like, not anymore. He got talent. He recruited California kids. He got them in there. And he made them a perennial, you know, champ in the WAC and Mountain West, and made them almost a perennial Sweet 16 every year in the tournament. He was a guy that really coached it up and did – you know, did very well. So I think there is a blueprint for that. But I also, like I said, I understand to Steve Alford, anybody saying, I want to win here, but God, if I can win at this said school where it's basketball, there's just something about that. It's probably the ego drive to say, if I can win at this highest level, then that really is a legacy and something I want to challenge myself with. But to your point, yeah, maybe he looks back now and says, you know, I did have a good at New Mexico, and maybe regrets, maybe not the right word, but saying, you know what, that was kind of special. And, you know, maybe at some point, not that he'd ever come back there to Albuquerque, I don't think you're welcome back, but maybe he wouldn't mind doing that again at a place saying, it's comfortable here and maybe I can build it and build my legacy by taking a program that's probably pretty good, but getting it to the next level and making them close to being an elite program.
Yeah, I mean, and realistically, he's never going to go back to it. I mean, they wouldn't even, I don't think they'd ever bring him back, do you think?
No. No, I just because it's like anything else, it's probably how you leave. I mean, the only guy I know that's gone back after leaving a place, and it's a different situation, is Mike Riley. How many times did Mike Riley, and we're talking football now, how many times did Mike Riley go back to Oregon State? Three times in his career after leaving for the NFL and leaving for Alabama and then leaving for Nebraska. I mean, that's extremely rare that the person goes back.
Well,
but I think it depends on how you leave the program and the shape you leave the program in when you leave.
There's no doubt. And the coach that I'm thinking of that I'm paralleling here is a guy named Greg Marshall, the coach at Wichita State. You'll recall,
Yes. You'll
recall he made his name at Winthrop. He went 194-83 there. Remember, they were going to the NCAA every year, and he became a hot commodity, and I mean, major P5 schools wanted him. Where did he go, and where is he still at? Wichita State. At Wichita State, he has gone 290-101. And here's a guy, Wichita, for those who've never been there, is a great city. It's a classic Midwest city. There's plenty of places to eat. There's plenty of arts. Yeah, it's cold in the winter and it's hot in the summer, but it's a wonderful place. He's found a home there. He's playing in front of sellout crowds every single night. Look at his last few years, Marty. 25-8, 31-5, 26-9, 30-5, and 35-1. He is a perennial NCAA team, his team. And, I mean, he's been an NIT champion. Why would he ever leave there? Because he's got everything he needs in the way of a national recruiting base now, because everybody knows they're a big-time program. They've gone from the Missouri Valley to the American Athletic Conference. You know, it's become one of the hot flavor, you know, hot-button conferences for football, but it's certainly getting there in basketball. He has there's nothing he can get anywhere else that he hasn't already gotten at Wichita State.
Right, and the thing, too, with that programming is the Wichita State, there's a legacy prior to him.
Yep.
There, it had been kind of dormant for a while, but you think about Xavier McDaniels and some of the players that came through. So he took a program that had a history when you and I were younger, 70s and 80s, and he's built it back up to that place. And to your point, I think the fact that, and back in the day, you and I know this, and for younger people, the Missouri Valley Conference used to be an awesome,
huge.
It still is a decent basketball conference, but now that Creighton's gone and they've gone to the Big East, explain geography to me there, but it's the fact that it's a Catholic college. The fact that Wichita State left the Missouri Valley and is now in the AAC or whatever. I mean, I think that's something that's probably kept his interest piqued as well, because now, instead of playing Bradley, no disrespect, because Bradley used to be a good program, now he's playing Memphis, and now he's playing some of the Florida schools that always get talent, and he's playing some schools that he feels, from a basketball standpoint, make his school more of a peer, at least that they can compete with. I mean, and there were rumors a couple of years ago, recently, that the Mountain West was thinking about adding not only Gonzaga, but adding Wichita State as basketball-only members. And God, imagine if they'd have done that. I think that's why, and I think to your point, he's in Kansas, which is kind of a hotbed for basketball. No one, you know, respectfully is going to confuse Wichita State with KU, but they're every bit as good, if not better, than K-State.
Well,
from a situation. So why bother when you say, I've got a good right here and I can make this program, I can make it an Elite Eight or Final Four? And he's done that. We've taken him to the Sweet 16.
Well, and you said Bradley. Bradley used to be one of the great programs in college basketball. They've been an NCAA runner-up twice. They've been in the Final Four twice, Elite Eight three times. You know, this is they delivered Chet Walker. And think about the Missouri Valley.
Hersey Hawkins.
Think about
who
were the original teams in the Missouri Valley? Louisville, Memphis, when they were known as Memphis State, and Cincinnati in Oscar Robertson's days. Those three programs,
right,
along with Bradley back in the Chet Walker days, Drake, which was a powerhouse, Memphis State with in the Larry Keenan days. I mean, those programs were powerhouses. UCLA, Bradley used to play in a 7,300-seat fieldhouse called Robertson Memorial Fieldhouse. John Wooden would not go and play them in Peoria. He said, I'll only play you at Chicago Stadium. And that's where they went. And Bradley, back in the day, still almost beat him. That was a great conference back then.
No, it was. You know, but now that money's more involved, some of these smaller conferences that were really elite, you've seen that shift. And again, bringing it kind of full circle, I think what's kept Marshall there is that his team has bumped up into, you know, probably a better, more competitive league. So it makes it, if you want to say, more competitive, more interesting for him. Probably helps a little bit with recruiting, though. I mean, I think even if he would have stayed where he was at, he'd still get great players. But I think those things intrigue him more, and I think it gives his team a better opportunity to take them even further than what he's already taken. Basketball is a different widget in many ways than football because in some of those smaller conferences, they play a good brand of basketball. And let's face it, not everybody can play in the top 25 schools, not because they're not good enough, but because you only have, 12 spots on a team, X amount of scholarships. So it's not like playing football where you can get 50, 60 guys or whatever on scholarship. It's tougher. So smaller programs that don't maybe have the brand name can be successful because there's a talent pool that's different because you have less guys playing the sport.
And that's one of the reasons why UCLA was so successful for so many years under John Wooden, because he would get 17, 18 guys if he wanted on his team. He could get, you know, the best of the best. And it was impossible once they started to win, Marty, it was impossible for anybody to compete with them.
No, absolutely. Which why, again, conflating sports. If you remember back in the day, Oklahoma and Nebraska, when you could have 80, 90 scholarships, they basically recruit kids away from other schools. And those kids would never see it down. But they said, you know what, I'd rather have you sit on the bench for us than playing for our rival. And they used to do that all the time.
That's right. Marty Lenz is my guest. More with Marty coming up. We're going to talk about the national championship game. We'll talk about Nick Saban, Dabo Sweeney, Trevor Lawrence, Jalen Hurts, who has applied for the NCAA transfer portal. Where's he going to end up? I'm also going to replay my 3 minutes or so with Nick Saban, because I want Marty to talk about this. I had a chance to talk with Nick Saban, as most of you know. We played that for you. What did I ask him? Well, of course I asked him about the college football playoff. All that's coming up with Marty. Marty spends the 4 o'clock hour with us every Wednesday. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
A little programming note for you. There will not be a coach's show this week. That'll be tomorrow night, but it'll be back next week at the Elbow Room. No coach's show on Thursday. And again, coming up 5:15 pregame, Utah State hosting Fresno State. Saturday night, Save Mart Center. It will be Nevada coming in, the Wolfpack, to take on Fresno State. Talk with Marty Lenz, as we do every Wednesday. National championship game. Of course, our audience here certainly knows that we were up there for the weekend. Marty had a great time getting a chance to interview. Sean McDonald was fantastic. Same with Rocket Ishmael, Sean Alexander, Bonnie Bernstein, and UAB's Bill Clark, the Eddie Robinson Coach of the Year. I wanted to take you back I'm not going to play this yet. I'm going to play some Nick Saban audio for you in a minute, but I want to take you back to Media Day, because the first hour was Alabama. There was a half hour off for everybody to kind of collect themselves and get their notes ready and stuff, and then the next hour was Clemson.
Get a beverage.
Get a beverage. Actually, yeah, it was more like a chicken sandwich.
Are we doing good, or do we suck? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, well, yeah, a little bit of that. But it was interesting because Alabama was there, and Alabama, just by my judgment, and I talked to Nick Saban, I talked to Tua Tagovailoa, and I had a chance to listen to pretty much everybody who was there, and then you had all the tables separated by defense and offense, and I had a chance to talk to a number of the Bama players, and then I did the same thing with Clemson. I spoke with Dabo Sweeney. I spoke with Trevor Lawrence, and just, you know, looked at Brett Venables and all, and then spoke to a lot of the Clemson players. Now, I went into the game, Marty. I was rooting for Clemson. If I'm going to root for anybody, I'm going to root for Clemson in that game, but I really felt that Bama was going to win. And I say that because at Media Day, and it's interesting now to look back on this, which was 2 days before the game, I left the SAP Center where the Sharks play, Marty. I left there thinking, boy, I'll tell you, between the two teams, Bama seems tight. And maybe it was just a gut feeling, and maybe I was just imagining it, but they really felt overall tight. And I thought, that seems odd for a team that has been in this spot so many times. Clemson has as well, not as many as Bama, but in terms of the current players, they both had been there, you know, the same amount of times. Clemson was decidedly calmer and looser and having more fun than Bama's players. And for what it's worth, if you want to connect those dots, Marty, I mean, even between the coaches, Saban was great. He offered tons of depth and nuance to his answers. Dabo was imitating Stephen A. Smith. He was entertaining. He was making jokes. He came out in a suit and tie. Within 30 seconds, the tie came off. Monday night was very much a reflection, Marty, of what I saw and felt and heard and on Saturday at Media Day.
Just want to say for 10 seconds, I hope your listeners realize that, Christopher, you are a major market talent. To have that access and do what you did, and I listened to some of that, that was absolutely fantastic radio. Now, moving forward.
Well, thank you.
Taking on the personality of the coaches, you're right. I kind of, because it's funny you say tight, because Nick Saban, he a lot of times can be a little surly and difficult, but I got the sense that he was tight. So you're totally right. I think the teams took on the personalities of their coaches in this game. Nick Saban, this is obviously not his first rodeo. Hell, it's his seventh. So you would think he'd be a little more loose. I have not seen him, if you want to say, as tight for some of the other games, even games that I think he felt that he wasn't sure his team maybe would have a shot, but maybe became victorious. I think that he was more wound tight for this game than I've seen him in other high pressure in other national championship games. And I think that did come out on the field. And you know how here's the thing with Clemson that my takeaway, and you're right, Dabo Swinney, he's kind of a character in a good way, right? He's a guy you like. Even if you don't root for the team, you just kind of like him. I'm not sure you say that about Nick Saban. You may root for the team, but you may think, Nick Saban's kind of got that Urban Meyer thing going on, or you may like the team, but there's just something about him that kind of horks you off a little bit. But you like Dabo Swinney. When Clemson, got the pick six, and then Alabama comes down to the field, and then Clemson scores again, and Alabama, never at any point did I think, Clemson's not afraid. They may be down, but they're not afraid. And you know why? They go on the field, and they're playing very loose and very confident football. And that's what I saw, and that was the difference. So it is interesting you pointed out, and you were there seeing it physically and actually talking to them. But as an observer and watching things, I was like, God, Nick Saban's a little tight, which kind of surprised me. But then his team played that way. And to your point, Dabo Swinney, a little more loose, a little more fun. And I think that was one of the messages. I think he told his kids, just go have fun. Go have fun and play. And that's what they did. And, man, they played. And they left no doubt who the best team was on the field. A lot of times these games are close. Clemson dominated that game, took it to them.
Yeah, they really did. There was nothing iffy about that game. It was interesting watching this game play out and being in the thick of it. As I've told our audience, Marty, I had the great good fortune. We get jaded. We're in press boxes and they're glassed off. And so you don't really get a sense of the intensity of the crowd, but I was in the auxiliary press box, so I was at the 200 level, out in the mix, and I mean you could feel the intensity of the crowd, the intensity of the moment, how special it was. And what I noticed about the game from my perspective was everybody on Clemson, it didn't matter which side of the ball they were on, Marty. Everybody wanted to put a lick on the guy in front of him, and that included Trevor Lawrence. I mean, you wanted him to slide a few more times. He was initiating a lot of contact when he would take that ball and run it. I was so impressed with them. And here's the thing. Dabo said to me, and he said, I had Ivan Mazel from ESPN right next to me, and we were both kind of trading off some questions. I can't believe that I'm next to Ivan Mazel, and we're trading off questions to Dabo Swinney. It was really a cool thing, Marty. I'll say this real quick, a sidebar to this. We've been in this business a long time, you longer than me. I never take these moments for granted. It is such a privilege to have a chance to work at these kinds of events, and so many people would like to be there, and so we try to do the best job we can to bring that to them. But it was just this wonderful feeling to have these talented writers around us asking questions and being able to be right there. And where I'm going with this is that Dabo flat out said to Ivan and to me and to several others, I'm not showing any disrespect to Alabama. And he had just told me how much he just, is impressed with Bama, what a great team they are, but he didn't.
He's an alum. It's his school.
Yes,
I mean, you think about that.
He, Marty,
his school. Yeah.
He, right, exactly. But he didn't hesitate to say, we are the better team. We believe we're the better team. We just have to win a few of these. That was his exact quote. We just have to win a few of these to be considered on the same level with Bama. Marty, I think they're considered on the same level with Bama right now.
Well, they were. And Coach is 100% right, because you can believe it, and maybe even the film bears it out or whatever else. But until you win them, until you win consistently, then you're not going to maybe considered. That it was Battle Royale number 4,
yeah.
3 for the national championship. And they're 2-2.
Yeah.
And the two wins that Sweeney has are national championship games. Saban has a national championship game and then has the semifinals.
Right.
So no. Now I think, and this is where Dabo Swinney, I love coaches that have self-awareness, and he has total self-awareness. He's aware of what's going on. He's aware of Nick Saban's legacy. And like I said, for what it's worth, he's an Alabama alum, Dabo Swinney. So he understands the legacy of Alabama. So all that comes to bear with him. And then what he's done with Clemson, in many ways building it in a similar image of Alabama, different styles of football, different conferences. So there's going to be, some of those nuances. But he totally, totally gets it. And I think what you do, that's not being cocky. That's just being confident and telling your kids, hey, guys, we're everybody's good out there. Tell Trevor Lawrence,
yes. You're
everybody as good as Tua Tagovailoa. You tell your receivers, you're everybody as these guys. You're every bit as good. And you may even say, and we're better. We're better in this position. We're better in this position. And then I bet you he tells them, but guys, doesn't mean a hill of spit unless we go out and prove it on the field. I guarantee you that's what he said. Something to that effect.
Yeah. No, absolutely. More with our good friend Marty Lentz coming up. Coming up in the next segment, I asked a question of Coach Saban. I had the opportunity, and I asked him, and boy, does he give a thoughtful, nuanced, depth-filled answer on the college football playoff. Marty, I'm not sure if Marty's heard that yet, but I'm going to play it again. It's a couple of minutes long, and then I'm going to get Marty's reaction to what Coach Saban said regarding the college football playoffs and expansion. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
One of the subjects that we talk about on this program, or have talked about it a number of times, is the college football playoff. And I know some of you might have a little bit of fatigue to that, but this is not a subject that's going to be going away anytime. Very interesting. The people that I had a chance to talk with when I was at Audio Avenue, folks from SiriusXM, folks from Alabama and Clemson, folks from ESPN Radio, and ESPN, the TV side as well. Just interesting opinions from everybody all the way around. We're talking with Marty Lentz. Marty hasn't had a chance to hear this, but at Media Day, I did get my moment with Coach Nick Saban from Alabama, and here it is.
Coach, you said that you are happy with where the college football playoff is right now, four teams. There are some others, Brian Kelly among them, who says there's an appetite for this to grow beyond four. Why do you believe four is the good number? And if it goes to eight or more, how does that affect you and the University of Alabama?
Well, my view is from 1,000 feet. How does it affect college football? Not how it affects Alabama, or not really even whether four is the right number. I think when we had two, there was a lot of speculation all the time about was there another team that should have been one of those teams. I think since we've gotten to four, I think in most cases the best teams have always been in the playoffs. They may not have been ranked exactly 1, 2, 3, 4, but the committee has gotten the best teams, in the playoffs. There's always been speculation as to somebody else should have gotten in. But there's speculation in the basketball tournament, they have 68 teams, and then they have a two-hour show on the teams that got in or didn't get in or whatever. So I don't care if we have 68 teams in the playoffs, you're going to have that. So as long as you get the best teams in the playoff, I think that's fine. I think my issue and concern is there's been a unique – bowl games have made college experiences unique for a lot of student-athletes, programs, teams over the years. And I think the bigger the playoffs become, the less significance bowl games have. I said that when we started the playoff. I said it when we expanded the playoff last time. And it's true. There's players that aren't playing in bowl games. I mean, playing in the Sugar Bowl used to be a big thing. It used to be a really big thing. Playing in the Cotton Bowl, that was a big thing. Playing in the Orange Bowl, that was a really big thing. Playing in the Rose Bowl, because I coached in the Big Ten for a long time, that was huge. It was huge. Now we have players that choose not to play in those games because they're not in the playoffs. All right, so is that good for college football? I don't know. I mean, it's for everybody to answer for themselves. From a media standpoint, because there's so much attention on the playoffs, I can see why a lot of people in the media would like to see the playoffs expand. But there is an expense to that, and that's you minimize the importance of bowl games for a lot of players who had successful seasons. That used to be the unique thing about college football, is a lot of people got a lot of positive self-gratification for having a good season by going to a bowl game and getting rewarded to play another game against another good team.
He gave me, Marty, much more than I ever anticipated. What's your reaction?
It is very nuanced. Well, a couple of things. I think he brings up some very good points. And I love how he first said he comes at it from the 1,000-foot level. He does. He's there. He sees what's going on, and he's coached different places, so he gets that. And so he has a history that a lot of people don't. And he is right. I think the playoff has diminished some bowls. But then I would counter, and that's not the place to do it because you're asking questions. But if you're ever to have a debate, and I'd say to some degree that's good because we have way too many bowl games. So we need to lop off 10 to 15 right there. And that would actually, I think, actually enhance the bowls even more. And then secondarily, if they expand the playoff, you rotate the bowls like they do now for the playoff. So you make those bowls still important, but the Sugar Bowl hosts the semifinal. And then, you know, in 4 years, it'll host the national championship, just like they're doing. They rotate the bowls. The thing I find interesting about it, and this, I think, is somewhat the self-preservation piece that you and I have talked about. And that, again, when I did the research on this a decade ago about what the playoff is, he talked about, you know, you have a fine season, you cap the season with a bowl game. Oh, I sit there and say, well, isn't that the equivalent of a participation trophy? You win enough games, you go to a bowl game. Does it really signify that you had a worthwhile season to go to a bowl? And I would argue not necessarily, especially now when you have 6-6 teams going to bowls, because, again, we have too many, and they have to fill slots. So that's one thing. Secondly, and he does bring up a point that you and I have talked about, that if the bowl's not significant, that these kids sit out because they think about their prospects, which, again, I have no problem. But secondarily, and maybe we need to do and go back and check, but I think for any of the major bowls, did any of these kids, and I'm sure there's a few, sit out? I bet you they sat out for the Holiday Bowl. I'm sure they sat out for the Weed Eater Pullin Bowl, and I know that doesn't exist. But those bowls, totally understand. But I think for the major bowls, did anybody sit out the Orange or whatever the other bowls were, the playoffs? I'm sure it's less athletes because they realize that the bowl games, even if their team isn't in the playoff, that's still a big deal to be in the bowl game. So I'd like to see the actual data on that. So two things can be true. I think he's right in what he says, but then I'd also say, but I think having a playoff and expanding it, you get rid of the weaker sister bowl games. And he uses the NCAA tournament, and he's right about that. There's debate about, well, should this team get in at 69 or whatever else? So that's true. But to me, using that as a reason not to expand and make the playoff better, to me, is a specious argument.
Let me add to your point here. We're visiting with Marty Lenz of KOA News Radio. The perfect example is number 42 on Clemson, Christian Wilkins. This is a guy. First of all, he was the best defensive player on the field at Levi's Stadium Monday night, hands down, not even close. He dominated the game on the defensive side of the ball. For Clemson, there's a guy that might have been looking at a high third-round draft choice, maybe second. Here's a guy, Marty, who didn't have to come back. I mean, his senior year could have left for the NFL last year, came back. He could have sat out for this game. He wasn't about to do that. He just made himself more than likely a first-round draft choice by playing and dominating the way he did. And I'm not in the camp that is in favor of players missing games. I understand why they're doing it, and they make their decisions, and I'll never criticize a player for doing it. I'm just on the other side of it. You know, finish the journey. He is a perfect example, and there was so much NFL talent on that field Monday night, but he's a perfect example of how a game, you know, on the biggest stage, in the biggest moments for 3 hours, he just made himself probably several more million dollars.
Well, and that's the other point I make. I mean, some of these players don't because they want to protect their draft stock, and maybe you know you're a lock at a certain level, whether it's a first or second round. But I say the less you get exposed, the less people know about you, which I would counter in saying a kid, depending. But you know what? If you go out and play and have a really good game, that could elevate. I mean, yes, there's the risk of injury, but there's the risk of not being seen or having somebody steal your spot because they did play. And so they elevate their pick, and you don't elevate because you don't play and you're waiting. So there's always those inherent risks, and you bring up a great example. And it's a national championship game, too.
Sure.
And some of these kids really love college. I mean, not that they don't, but, I mean, it is special to win a championship, I think, or be a part of a championship team in college. Not that I was, but it is special to be part of that. And I think some of those kids really take that to heart, because they do see the legacy and saying, hey, we're Clemson. I can win a national championship, and I can do something special like that. So I think seeing him play, I think that elevates him to say, wow, he finished the task, to your point. He had a great game. Now his stock has risen even more. So there's the risk of playing and hurt, but the risk of not playing and not being seen is a problem as well. But I got to tell you, you're right, Nick. That is one of the most clear answers, even if I don't agree with all of it, that Nick Saban gave. And it makes you think, and it is. It's something you say, okay, I may not agree with it, but there's reason behind what he's saying. And a lot of what he's saying is fairly accurate. You could debate some of it, but I thought that was an excellent response he gave to your very good question.
Yeah, he was really thorough, and I really appreciated that. So let's move to one other side of this national championship equation. The folks we're visiting with our good friend Marty Lentz, KOA News Radio, former wide receiver at Colorado State. Marty is the co-host of Colorado's Morning News, a tremendous show out in Denver, Colorado. I'll get to Cliff Kingsbury in a second. Trevor Lawrence, I've said, and people are probably sick of me saying it, but I've said on a number of occasions, I believe that if he stays there for his at least 3 years or 4 years, he will rewrite the record books. How good can this kid be? As you, as a former football player, what do you see as the ceiling for him, Marty?
Well, I mean, talent aside, and it's easy to say because he's got ubers of talent, it's the intangibles of the maturity and the way he carries himself at what, 19, that is what blows me away. Because, and I say this respectfully, talent that he has, I don't want to say it's a dime a dozen, but there have been a lot of talented players and quarterbacks that have come through college football that have gone on to have great pro careers or maybe not. But it's the mental aspect of how you carry yourself, your presence, how do you elevate your other teammates. This kid's a freshman. And he's elevating. And what I love about him, again, his humility and self-awareness by saying, hey, these seniors and stuff, they kind of dragged me along to kind of bring me up to speed. But then, boy, once he got it, it clicked. He can be. There's no doubt about it that kid can be something special. But he's still young. He's still, even with his skill set, he's still raw. When people say, well, he could go to the NFL now, and I said, here's what you forget. There's guys that are paid millions of dollars on defense to scheme against him. So let's pump the brakes a little bit to say that he'd step into the league and be this, that, and the other thing. I think there, that comes with physical and even more maturity, though he's showing a lot of emotional maturity and everything else. So I do think he can be something special. But again, like I said, he proved himself well this year. Let's see what he does in year two, and then if he stays beyond that. But no, I mean, I think that's a kid, that's somebody you watch, and he's going to be the leader for the Heisman next year, I think, no doubt about it.
We're visiting with Marty Lentz. One more segment coming up. We're going to talk with Marty about Cliff Kingsbury. He's had 3 jobs in about 5 or 6 weeks. What a country that we live in. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
A couple more minutes with our good friend Marty Lentz, KOA News Radio. So, Marty, Cliff Kingsbury gets fired at Texas Tech. He certainly had a run of some pretty darn good quarterbacks, and nobody's going to question his ability to develop a quarterback. And USC makes him their target for the next offensive coordinator. SC has been a little bit offense-challenged. Clay Helton is needing somebody to help him stay employed, at least in Los Angeles, with Chip Kelly across town and turning up the heat, as especially with UCLA and Notre Dame beating SC this year. He goes there and then suddenly says, you know, I'm seeing some pro teams that are interested in me, and now he is the head coach of the Arizona Cardinals. What do you make of this new trend? And I don't want to do a compare and contrast with what players deal with, because players, when a coach suddenly leaves after players signing, players should be allowed to leave as well. And that's something that we've talked about forever. But how do teams ensure that can they ensure that a new coach or a new coordinator is going to stay longer than a Cliff Kingsbury or Manny Diaz at Temple, 18 days and he's back at Miami again?
I don't know if there's really a way you can do it. The Manny Diaz thing, that's, I see it a little different than Cliff Kingsbury, because again, the guy was a below 500 coach in the Big 12, which no one would confuse, at least right now, with the SEC. So it's kind of interesting. And then I say, and again, with all due respect, Texas Tech to me is still an outpost and of a place to be. Lubbock, Texas. If you've ever been there, Lord,
yeah,
help you.
It's a dust bowl. But then
to be offense coordinator at Southern California because of the success he had with Mahomes and some other, quarterbacks, Baker Mayfield with his time at Oklahoma, that's the new trend. You get the guy who's the quarterback whisperer, and I thought Clay Helton probably thinks, oh, this is the guy that can help get us there. But depending on how these contracts are ironclad, and I got to say this, it's the Arizona Cardinals, it's the Bidwell family who runs it, and they're dysfunctional, with a capital D in many ways. It's interesting that in many ways I think they're taking a flyer, but again, it's a copycat league. You've heard that say it. So they're taking the young guy who's the quarterback whisperer and an offensive genius, allegedly, to run the team with not a lot of success. So I don't know, I don't want to make of it and saying good luck, but, maybe there's something there that I don't see at this point. But, yeah, I mean, the whole thing about, do you honor a deal? What's the situation? And what I understood is Southern California said, no, you can't talk to anybody else. But, I mean, if the money's there and you can buy out the deal, then you take the risk. And I say this in Cliff Kingsbury's defense, offensive coordinator at Southern California, head coach in the NFL, Cardinals albeit, you sit there and say, why not? I got to take this opportunity because how many of them come around? There's only 32 jobs. And so he's doing what he thinks is probably best for him professionally and the challenge. I think he's different if he has a head coaching job at, it wasn't going to be at Southern California, but if he's got a head coaching job at a big Power 5 school, then I think maybe he takes pause and says, well, maybe I'll wait because if I succeed here, I can maybe get a better NFL job. But again, when the opportunity presents itself, sometimes you have to take it.
Well, and I don't think anybody's going to question the fact that the head coaching position for an NFL team is better than a coordinator position. I don't care what college program it is. But I guess the fact that SC initially didn't allow him to talk to anybody, didn't give permission, and then did, brings me to Vic Fangio. The Bears, he is considered one of the best defensive minds ever in the National Football League. And the Bears initially said, we're not going to give anybody permission to talk to him. And then they did. And now he's going to be the next coach of the team down the street from you. What was Denver now going for a defensive guy? Is that something that John Elway and or others inside the Broncos organization said they were going to be looking for?
Not really. I mean, this is interesting. And, of course, I always preface by saying I work at the Broncos station. I'll probably be talking to Coach Fangio in the next day or two. But two things come to mind. One, I thought, maybe it's good that they're not following the trend. Fangio's a bit of the outlier. They didn't go the offensive route with the young, brilliant guy. But that talent pool kind of dried up. It was between him and Mike Munchak. And I thought they'd lean Munchak because he was more offensive. And it had already been the criteria that John Elway laid out is he wanted somebody who had head coaching experience. Well, with all due respect to Vic Fangio, he does not, and he's 60. So you ask yourself, was he happy as a coordinator, which, again, there's nothing wrong, and he's waiting for the right job to line up, or did he not really generate interest to this point in his career? Because the trend in football now is NFL head coaches are trending younger, college coaches are trending older. So Fangio, again, is bucking that trend. The other reason I think they went with Fangio, too, is Gary Kubiak is going to come back into the fold and either be an offensive czar. I don't know if he'll be the OC because they still at least now have Bill Musgrave. But I think that's another thing, too, where they may actually be doing where you have a head coach, but in effect you have an associate head coach, but one really focuses on the offense, the other focuses on the defense, and that's Fangio's specialty is the defense. So I am somewhat curious by the pick because I really thought maybe of the two, Munchak may be the better. But I got to tell you, and we joked about this on the air with our insiders, none of the picks were overly sexy. If you want to go sexy, you try to get John Harbaugh. But when that wasn't going to happen and reveal itself, then you're like, okay, well, this is the pool we got to deal with, so what do we do? But again, everybody has sung the praises of Vic Fangio, his defensive players, other coaches. So, again, maybe there's something I don't know and I'm missing, and he has a right to prove us all wrong, and I guess we will see, as they say.
Last thing for you. We're going to hold some other stuff to next week. Last thing for you. So the Packers get rid of, they dismiss Mike McCarthy. and they bring in Matt LaFleur. I didn't see that coming, but nevertheless, LaFleur goes there. So the question has been, where will Mike McCarthy end up? McCarthy had made it very clear that the only job he was interested in, the New York Jets. The New York Jets, as reported by ESPN 2 minutes ago, saying they are expected to hire Adam Gase as their next head coach. So that doesn't surprise me, but McCarthy, if he decides that that's the only job he wanted, he won't go anywhere else. It's almost hard to see Mike McCarthy not in football. Do you see him at some point relenting or just waiting it out for a year for a better job to come along, because he certainly doesn't need the money?
Well, I think he may actually wait it out. And I got to tell you, and I say this, I don't know what the Cleveland Browns were doing. I thought, oh, it would be Greg Williams, but it's not him. They go with the running backs coach. And I was like, if you're going to replace Greg Williams, who at least got him, took him to
Freddie
5-3, you know, why don't you look at Mike McCarthy or maybe an established head coach, knowing that he worked with Aaron Rodgers and players of that ilk, if you will, of that like. It's kind of bizarre. I think McCarthy maybe just does the thing where he sits out for a year and maybe does wait for the opportunity. But, yeah, nothing against Adam Gase, but I can't believe that they wouldn't look at McCarthy over Adam Gase.
That's, I'm with you.
That's a screwy thing.
I'm with you. And I think the Browns hiring Freddie Kitchens, it seems to me from a distance, Marty, that they're banking on the fact that Kitchens and Baker Mayfield have struck up a fantastic professional relationship, and maybe to a certain extent, you know, a personal respect and what have you, and it seems like they wanted to keep that going. I think Freddie was in the mix, but I'm with you. I thought that McCarthy was at least going to get a look.
Yeah, well, and I would think so. And again, relationships do matter. And if your star player is having success and he feels comfortable with that guy or likes that, then there, I'm saying there's value. And conversely, that was the problem that I think let Mike McCarthy go in Green Bay, that his relationship with Aaron Rodgers had obviously soured. And so who are you going to get rid of?
Yeah.
You get rid of Aaron Rodgers, you get rid of the coach. But yeah, Mike McCarthy, I still think, is a good coach, a Super Bowl winning coach. And I think, obviously, I just don't, nothing else has revealed itself. So I think at this point, he may just sit out for the year, maybe do some analysis work, and then I'm sure he'll get his opportunity again next year.
Yep, absolutely. Good place to end it. We always enjoy having a chance to sit down with Marty Lentz for about an hour every Wednesday at 4:05. Marty, great stuff as always. We will catch up with you next week, my friend.
Hey, thank you. Take care.
All right, there you go. Marty. No, wow, no go Rams today. How about that? That's unusual. All right. Coming up, a brisk top five at 5, because we need to be out at 5:15 or Leffler's going to lose it. I'm just kidding. He's not going to lose it. Paul Leffler and Coach Q have the call pregame show out in Logan, Utah, Fresno State, Utah State. Glad you're hanging out with us. A 15-minute hour number 3 coming up next. This is the CGP.
The Top 5 at 5 is sponsored by the Law Office of Josh Lazar and Associates. And now, from Fresno, California, to the furthest reaches of the galaxy, here are your Top 5 at 5 sports talkers of the day.
Top 5 at 5. We do them a little faster than we normally do, which isn't always the easiest thing for me to do, because we're going to be out of here at 5:15 or thereabouts. Get you up to Logan, Utah. Paul Leffler, Coach Q, Fresno State, visiting Utah State. Let's begin.
Number 1.
DeAndre Francois is the quarterback at Florida State. And you'll recall a couple of years ago, back in 2016, when Florida State had a pretty great year, he had 20 TDs against 7 interceptions. And then he blew out his knee. And he only played, that was in the first game of the year when Florida State, I believe it was against Alabama. And then this year, he played in 11 games, wasn't nearly as effective. The team was not remotely what they had been a couple of years ago. Willie Taggart's first year, he had 15 TDs against 12 interceptions, not a great ratio. I mention this because Francois has decided that he is going to return for a senior season at Florida State. He said, "While my dream is to play in the NFL, at this time I feel that there are areas both within my game and my life that I need to improve upon to succeed at the next level. I don't take for granted the privilege it is to wear the garnet and gold. I love Florida State, my brothers, and I have much more to offer." My sense about that is that he probably got the word from the National Football League, because you get a grade. just like you do in college basketball, in college football, you can submit to, I'm not sure exactly what panel or how many individuals go into it, but they tell you exactly what your draft status is going to be in terms of what range you're going to be looked at from teams. And there was just no way that he was going to be a first or second round draft choice this year, third, maybe even third, not with the year that he had. So I think it's a very prudent decision on his part. But he's going to have some competition with a redshirt sophomore, James Blackman, and there is the possibility that he'll have some other competition, which leads us into this.
Number two.
So Jalen Hurts, of course, he was the face of Alabama, the Alabama quarterback position for a couple of seasons, certainly. He's a junior. He has 1 year of eligibility remaining, but he graduated in December, so he could transfer somewhere and be able to play immediately. And he has, in fact, put his name into the NCAA. They call it the transfer portal. The sources out of Alabama, out of Tuscaloosa, saying that it is the expectation that he will leave the Crimson Tide, but entering the portal doesn't lock him into doing so. This is a kid who was the SEC Offensive Player of the Year as a freshman. As I said, he's had two championship game appearances in his two seasons as a starter, 26-2 in that time, but Tua Tagovailoa beat him out for that. There's a lot of schools that are being thought of as a destination for him because, as I said, he can play right away. He can go to another SEC school. That in-conference rule is gone now, being that he's graduated already. He could go to Florida or Auburn, wherever, Tennessee, you name it, and play. Most people, and who knows, it's all speculation, but the speculation is, in terms of the schools that he might be looking at, one is TCU, another is Penn State, another is Michigan, another is Houston, and another is Florida State. I think that he's probably going to want to go somewhere that, this is a kid who's competed at the highest level. It's a kid who has, played in a couple of national championships. So he is a competitor, certainly. And he's an unbelievable player. But if you're going to roll the dice and transfer for your final year and have a chance to play right away, even though he is certainly of the character that he's ready to compete if he has to, he probably wants to go to a situation that he almost is certain he's going to play right away. So if you look around college football, where do you see possibilities that Jalen Hurts is going to play right away? That's the schools that I would look at as an idea of where he's going to land.
Number three.
Let's see. Colorado State. Mike Bobo, he's the head coach, didn't like his own performance this year, not to mention his team's, but he didn't like his own performance. The team went 3-9 in the Mountain West. Joe Parker is the CSU athletic director and offered Mike Bobo a $100,000 raise on top of his $1.8 million salary. Mike Bobo declined it. That's really impressive. He said, this is an administration that stood behind me, and I felt like we didn't live up to our end of the deal. I wanted to make a statement to our players that we're in this together, and you've got to be accountable, starting with me. Bobo said that Joe Parker just couldn't believe it. He said, are you sure? And Bobo said, I told Joe it was something I wanted to do. It's how I was raised. I didn't need to think about it. It's what I wanted to do. Then Parker came back and said, that's not typical. Doesn't usually happen. Just makes me realize we have a pretty special person who recognizes his own personal accountability and doesn't feel good about what occurred this season and is pointing all of his efforts into 2019. Yeah, it doesn't happen that often. I mean, when does it happen? When do you see a coach say, you know what, I don't want the raise. I don't want the raise. Because they had a bad year. It started off bad and it basically got worse as the year went on. But that's impressive. Good for him.
Number four.
Well, let's see. We've got a couple of options here. Let's go with DeMarcus Cousins. The thought is that he's going to return in the January 18th range. And I'm using that word because that's the word that Steve Kerr used. He said, I think it's going to happen around that time. It's not as simple as that's the game. It's somewhere in that neighborhood. Maybe it's the New Orleans game a couple days earlier. Maybe it's the first game after that. But that's definitely the range. I'd say the last two scrimmages he's had, it's looked to us and it's felt to him that he's broken through a barrier. We were waiting for that barrier, so that he's through that barrier, and assuming everything goes well the next week or two, that's sort of the idea to get him back in sometime that week. Boy, they can sure use him, can't they? I mean, this is a team that, when they've tried to flip the switch, hasn't always worked. Hasn't always worked. They've had their injuries. You've followed the progress of the team this year. You know what's going on. But when you look at the Golden State Warriors, right now, you look at the league as a whole. Toronto is 31-12, best record in the East. Best record in the West is Denver. They're at 27-12. Hard to understand how one team has played four more games than another. I don't think Denver's had any games canceled for any reason. Golden State sitting behind them in the Western Conference at 27-14, but which is fine. You know, they have the third best record in the NBA. Fourth best, I'm sorry. The Milwaukee Bucks have a better record than they do as well. But they haven't been the same. I mean, this team, as you well know, you look at them in the last three, 4 years, looking at them with 12 losses, that's usually something that you see sometime around April, not early January. So it's going to be interesting if he is, in fact, completely healthy. He doesn't come back 90%, 95%, but if he's completely healthy, it will be interesting to see what he does to this team. If this whole team is healthy, I remain committed to what I said before. They're not losing in the NBA Finals. And they'll get to the NBA Finals, and they will win. I don't think they get upset by anybody, but they have not looked the way they've looked the last couple of years.
Number 5.
Last story for you. Former LSU offensive lineman was shot while duck hunting in Mississippi last month, and unfortunately, the end of the story is that he loses his leg in the doing. Micah Heckford, he and several others were on a duck hunting trip, and Matt Branch was accidentally hit by a blast from his shotgun, which he had left loaded in the bed of his pickup truck. But what he said happened was a Labrador retriever named Tito jumped onto the truck bed, stepped on the safety, and, quote, pulled the trigger. It's a tragic accident. He loses his leg. It sounds more like the safety went off, and that was that. But I don't know that the dog could pull the trigger. My thanks to Todd Suntrapek, CEO, president of Valley Children's, and Marty Lenz from KOA News Radio, and my guy Russ doing his usual great job. Folks, we're going to send you out to Logan, Utah. Paul Leffler, Coach Q. Bulldogs basketball taking on Utah State. We'll see you in 22 hours. Until then, you're on your own.